This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Kristen Hughes. The Amateur Cracksman by E. W. Horning. To A.C.D. This Form of Flattery. The Ides of March, Part 1. It was 12:30 when I returned to the Albany as a last desperate resort. The scene of my disaster was much as I had left it. The baccarat counters still strewed the table, with the empty glasses and the loaded ashtrays. A window had been opened to let the smoke out, and was letting in the fog instead. Raffles himself had merely discarded his dining jacket for one of his innumerable blazers. Yet he arched his eyebrows as though I had dragged him from his bed.
"Forgotten something?"
said he, when he saw me on his mat. "No," said I, pushing past him without ceremony, and I led the way into his rooms with an impudence amazing to myself.
"Not come back for your revenge, have you? Because I'm afraid I can't give it to you single-handed. I was sorry myself that the others—"
We were face to face by his fireside, and I cut him short. "Raffles," said I, "you may well be surprised at my coming back in this way, and at this hour. I hardly know you. I was never in your rooms before to-night, but I fagged for you at school, and you said you remembered me. Of course, that's no excuse, but will you listen to me for 2 minutes?" In my emotion I had at first to struggle for every word, but his face reassured me as I went on, and I was not mistaken in its expression.
"Certainly, my dear man," said he. "As many minutes as you like. Have a Sullivan and sit down."
And he handed me his silver cigarette-case. "No," said I, finding a full voice as I shook my head. "No, I won't smoke, and I won't sit down, thank you. Nor will you ask me to do either when you've heard what I have to say."
"Really?"
said he, lighting his own cigarette with one clear blue eye upon me.
"How do you know?"
"Because you'll probably show me the door," I cried bitterly. "And you will be justified in doing it. But it's no use beating about the bush. You know I dropped over 200 just now." He nodded. "I hadn't the money in my pocket."
"I remember."
"But I had my cheque-book, and I wrote each of you a cheque at that desk."
"Well?"
"Not one of them was worth the paper it was written on, Raffles. I am overdrawn already at my bank."
"Surely only for the moment."
"No, I have spent everything."
"But somebody told me you were so well off. I heard you had come in for money."
"So I did, 3 years ago. It has been my curse. Now it's all gone, every penny. Yes, I've been a fool. There never was nor will be such a fool as I've been. Isn't this enough for you? Why don't you turn me out?" He was walking up and down with a very long face instead.
"Couldn't your people do anything?"
he asked at length. "Thank God!" I cried. "I have no people. I was an only child. I came in for everything there was. My one comfort is that they're gone and will never know." I cast myself into a chair and hid my face. Raffles continued to pace the rich carpet that was of a piece with everything else in his rooms. There was no variation in his soft and even footfalls.
"You used to be a literary little cuss," he said at length. "Didn't you edit the Mag before you left? Anyway, I recollect fagging you to do my verses. And literature of all sorts is the very thing nowadays. Any fool can make a living at it."
I shook my head. "Any fool couldn't write off my debts," said I.
"Then you have a flat somewhere?"
he went on. "Yes, in Mount Street."
"Well, what about the furniture?"
I laughed aloud in my misery. "There has been a bill of sale on every stick for months." And at that Raffles stood still, with raised eyebrows and stern eyes, that I could meet the better now that he knew the worst. Then, with a shrug, he resumed his walk, and for some minutes neither of us spoke. But in his handsome, unmoved face I read my fate and death warrant, and with every breath I cursed my folly and my cowardice in coming to him at all. Because he had been kind to me at school, when he was captain of the 11 and I his fag, I had dared to look for kindness from him now, because I was ruined, and he rich enough to play cricket all the summer and do nothing for the rest of the year. I had fatuously counted on his mercy, his sympathy, his help. Yes, I had relied on him in my heart, for all my outward diffidence and humility, and I was rightly served. There was as little of mercy as of sympathy in that curling nostril, that rigid jaw, that cold blue eye which never glanced my way. I caught up my hat. I blundered to my feet. I would have gone without a word, but Raffles stood between me and the door.
"Where are you going?" said he.
"That's my business," I replied. "I won't trouble you any more."
"Then how am I to help you?"
"I didn't ask your help."
"Then why come to me?"
"Why, indeed," I echoed. "Will you let me pass?"
"Not until you tell me where you are going and what you mean to do."
"Can't you guess?" I cried, and for many seconds we stood staring in each other's eyes.
"Have you got the pluck?"
said he, breaking the spell in a tone so cynical that it brought my last drop of blood to the boil. "You shall see," said I, as I stepped back and whipped the pistol from my overcoat pocket. "Now, will you let me pass, or shall I do it here?" The barrel touched my temple, and my thumb the trigger. Mad with excitement as I was, ruined, dishonored, and now finally determined to make an end of my misspent life, my only surprise to this day is that I did not do so then and there. The despicable satisfaction of involving another in one's destruction added its miserable appeal to my baser egoism. And had fear or horror flown to my companion's face, I shudder to think I might have died diabolically happy with that look for my last impious consolation. It was the look that came instead which held my hand. Neither fear nor horror were in it. Only wonder, admiration, and such a measure of pleased expectancy as caused me, after all, to pocket my revolver with an oath. "You devil!" I said. "I believe you wanted me to do it!"
"Not quite,"
was the reply, made with a little start and a change of color that came too late.
"To tell you the truth, though, I half thought you meant it, and I was never more fascinated in my life. I never dreamt you had such stuff in you, Bunny. No, I'm hanged if I will let you go now. And you'd better not try that game again, for you won't catch me stand and look on a second time. We must think of some way out of the mess. I had no idea you were a chap of that sort. There, let me have the gun."
One of his hands fell kindly on my shoulder, while the other slipped into my overcoat pocket, and I suffered him to deprive me of my weapon without a murmur. Nor was this simply because Raffles had the subtle power of making himself irresistible at will. He was beyond comparison the most masterful man whom I have ever known. Yet my acquiescence was due to more than the mere subjection of the weaker nature to the stronger. The forlorn hope which had brought me to the Albany was turned as by magic into an almost staggering sense of safety. Raffles would help me after all. A.J. Raffles would be my friend. It was as though all the world had come round suddenly to my side. So far, therefore, from resisting his action, I caught and clasped his hand with a fervor as uncontrollable as the frenzy which had preceded it. "God bless you!" I cried. "Forgive me for everything. I will tell you the truth. I did think you might help me in my extremity. Though I well knew that I had no claim upon you, still, for the old school's sake, the sake of old times, I thought you might give me another chance. If you wouldn't, I meant to blow out my brains, and will still if you change your mind." In truth, I feared that it was changing with his expression even as I spoke, and in spite of his kindly tone and kindlier use of my old school nickname. His next words showed me my mistake.
"What a boy it is for jumping to conclusions! I have my vices, Bunny, but backing and filling is not one of them. Sit down, my good fellow, and have a cigarette to soothe your nerves. I insist. Whiskey? The worst thing for you. Here's some coffee that I was brewing when you came in. Now listen to me. You speak of another chance. What do you mean? Another chance at baccarat? Not if I know it. You think the luck must turn. Suppose it didn't. We should only have made bad worse. No, my dear chap, you've plunged enough. Do you put yourself in my hands, or do you not? Very well. Then you plunge no more, and I undertake not to present my check. Unfortunately, there are the other men. And still more unfortunately, Bunny, I'm as hard up at this moment as you are yourself.
It was my turn to stare at Raffles. You? I vociferated. You hard up? How am I to sit here and believe that?
Did I refuse to believe it of you? He returned, smiling. And with your own experience, do you think that because a fellow has rooms in this place, and belongs to a club or two, and plays a little cricket, he must necessarily have a balance at the bank? I tell you, my dear man, that at this moment I'm as hard up as you ever were. I have nothing but my wits to live on, absolutely nothing else. It was as necessary for me to win some money this evening as it was for you. We're in the same boat, Bunny. We'd better pull together.
Together? I jumped at it. I'll do anything in this world for you, Raffles, I said, if you really mean that you won't give me away. Think of anything you like, and I'll do it. I was a desperate man when I came here, and I'm just as desperate now. I don't mind what I do, if only I can get out of this without a scandal. Again I see him, leaning back in one of the luxurious chairs with which his room was furnished. I see his indolent, athletic figure, his pale, sharp, clean-shaven features, his curly black hair, his strong, unscrupulous mouth. And again I feel the clear beam of his wonderful eye, cold and luminous as a star, shining into my brain, sifting the very secrets of my heart.
"I wonder if you mean all that," he said at length. "You do in your present mood, but who can back his mood to last? Still, there's hope when a chap takes that tone. Now I think of it, too, you were a plucky little devil at school. You once did me a rather good turn, I recollect. Remember it, Bunny? Well, wait a bit, and perhaps I'll be able to do you a better one. Give me time to think."
He got up, lit a fresh cigarette, and fell to pacing the room once more, but with a slower and more thoughtful step, and for a much longer period than before. Twice he stopped at my chair as though on the point of speaking, but each time he checked himself and resumed his stride in silence. Once he threw up the window, which he had shut some time since, and stood for some moments leaning out into the fog which filled the Albany courtyard. Meanwhile a clock on the chimney-piece struck one, and one again for the half-hour, without a word between us. Yet I not only kept my chair with patience, but I acquired an incongruous equanimity in that half-hour. Insensibly I had shifted my burden to the broad shoulders of this splendid friend, and my thoughts wandered with my eyes as the minutes passed. The room was the good-sized square one with the folding doors, the marble mantelpiece, and the gloomy old-fashioned distinction peculiar to the Albany. It was charmingly furnished and arranged, with the right amount of negligence and the right amount of taste. What struck me most, however, was the absence of the usual insignia of a cricketer's den. Instead of the conventional rack of war-worn bats, a carved oak bookcase, with every shelf in a litter, filled the better part of one wall. And where I looked for cricketing groups, I found reproductions of such works as Love and Death and The Blessed Damozel in dusty frames and different parallels. The man might have been a minor poet instead of an athlete of the first water, but there had always been a fine streak of aestheticism in his complex composition. Some of these very pictures I had myself dusted in his study at school, and they set me thinking of yet another of his many sides, and of the little incident to which he had just referred. Everybody knows how largely the tone of a public school depends on that of the 11, and on the character of the captain of cricket in particular. And I have never heard it denied that in A.J. Raffles' time our tone was good, or that such influence as he troubled to exert was on the side of the angels. Yet it was whispered in the school that he was in the habit of parading the town at night in loud checks and a false beard. It was whispered and disbelieved. I alone knew it for a fact, for night after night I had pulled the rope up after him when the rest of the dormitory were asleep, and kept awake by the hour to let it down again on a given signal. Well, one night he was overbold, and within an ace of ignominious expulsion in the heyday of his fame. Consummate daring and extraordinary nerve on his part, aided doubtless by some little presence of mind on mine, averted the untoward result, and no more need be said of a discreditable incident. But I cannot pretend to have forgotten it in throwing myself on this man's mercy in my desperation, and I was wondering how much of his leniency was owing to the fact that Raffles had not forgotten it either, when he stopped and stood over my chair once more.
"I've been thinking of that night we had the narrow squeak," he began. "Why do you start?"
"I was thinking of it, too." He smiled, as though he had read my thoughts.
"Well, you were the right sort of little beggar then, Bunny. You didn't talk and you didn't flinch. You asked no questions and you told no tales. I wonder if you're like that now."
"I don't know," said I, slightly puzzled by his tone. "I've made such a mess of my own affairs that I trust myself about as little as I'm likely to be trusted by anybody else. Yet I never in my life went back on a friend. I will say that. Otherwise, perhaps, I mightn't be in such a hole to-night."
"Exactly,"
said Raffles, nodding to himself, as though in assent to some hidden train of thought.
"Exactly what I remember of you. And I'll bet it's as true now as it was 10 years ago. We don't alter, Bunny, we only develop. I suppose neither you nor I are really altered since you used to let down that rope, and I used to come up it hand over hand. You would stick at nothing for a pal, what?"
"At nothing in this world!" I was pleased to cry.
"Not even at a crime?" said Raffles, smiling.
I stopped to think, for his tone had changed, and I felt sure he was chaffing me. Yet his eyes seemed as much in earnest as ever, and for my part I was in no mood for reservations. "No, not even at that," I declared. "Name your crime, and I'm your man." He looked at me, one moment in wonder, and another moment in doubt, then turned the matter off with a shake of his head, and the little cynical laugh that was all his own.
"You're a nice chap, Bunny. A real desperate character, what? Suicide one moment, and any crime I like the next. What you want is a drag, my boy, and you did well to come to a decent law-abiding citizen with a reputation to lose. Nonetheless, we must have that money to-night, by hook or crook."
"To-night, Raffles?"
"The sooner the better. Every hour after 10 o'clock to-morrow morning is an hour of risk. Let one of those checks get round to your own bank, and you and it are dishonored together. No, we must raise the wind to-night, and reopen your account first thing to-morrow, and I rather think I know where the wind can be raised."
"At 2 o'clock in the morning?"
"Yes."
"But how, but where, at such an hour?"
"From a friend of mine here in Bond Street."
"He must be a very intimate friend."
"Intimate's not the word. I have the run of his place and a latch-key all to myself."
"And you would knock him up at this hour of the night?"
"If he's in bed."
"And it's essential that I should go in with you?"
"Absolutely."
"Then I must. But I'm bound to say I don't like the idea, Raffles."
"Do you prefer the alternative?"
asked my companion with a sneer.
"No, hang it, that's unfair,"
he cried apologetically in the same breath.
"I quite understand. It's a beastly ordeal. But it would never do for you to stay outside. I tell you what, you shall have a peg before we start. Just one. There's the whiskey, here's a siphon. I'll be putting on an overcoat while you help yourself. Well, I dare say I did so with some freedom, for this plan of his was not the less distasteful to me from its apparent inevitability. I must own, however, that it possessed fewer terrors before my glass was empty. Meanwhile, Raffles rejoined me, with a covert coat over his blazer, and a soft felt hat set carelessly on the curly head he shook with a smile as I passed him the decanter.
"When we come back," said he, "work first, play afterward. Do you see what day it is?"
he added, tearing a leaflet from a Shakespearean calendar as I drained my glass.
"March 15th. The Ides of March, the Ides of March, remember. Eh, Bunny, my boy? You won't forget them, will you?"
And with a laugh, he threw some coals on the fire before turning down the gas like a careful householder. So we went out together, as the clock on the chimney-piece was striking two. Part Two. Piccadilly was a trench of raw white fog, rimmed with blurred street lamps, and lined with a thin coating of adhesive mud. We met no other wayfarers on the deserted flagstones, and were ourselves favoured with a very hard stare from the constable of the beat, who, however, touched his helmet on recognizing my companion.
"You see, I'm known to the police,"
laughed Raffles as we passed on.
"Poor devils! They've got to keep their weather eye open on a night like this. A fog may be a bore to you and me, Bunny, but it's a perfect godsend to the criminal classes, especially so late in their season. Here we are, though I'm hanged if the beggar isn't in bed and asleep after all."
We had turned into Bond Street, and had halted on the curb a few yards down on the right. Raffles was gazing up at some windows across the road, windows barely discernible through the mist, and without the glimmer of a light to throw them out. They were over a jeweler's shop, as I could see by the peep-hole in the shop door, and the bright light burning within. But the entire upper part, with the private street door next the shop, was black and blank as the sky itself. "Better give it up for tonight," I urged. "Surely the morning will be time enough."
"Not a bit of it," said Raffles. "I have his key. We'll surprise him. Come along."
And seizing my right arm, he hurried me across the road, opened the door with his latch-key, and in another moment had shut it swiftly but softly behind us. We stood together in the dark. Outside, a measured step was approaching. We had heard it through the fog as we crossed the street. Now, as it drew nearer, my companion's fingers tightened on my arm.
"It may be the chap himself," he whispered. "He's the devil of a night-bird. Not a sound, Bunny. We'll startle the life out of him."
"Ah!" The measured step had passed without a pause. Raffles drew a deep breath, and his singular grip of me slowly relaxed.
"But still, not a sound," he continued in the same whisper. "We'll take a rise out of him, wherever he is. Slip off your shoes and follow me."
Well, you may wonder at my doing so, but you can never have met A.J. Raffles. Half his power lay in a conciliating trick of sinking the commander in the leader, and it was impossible not to follow one who led with such a zest. You might question, but you followed first. So now, when I heard him kick off his own shoes, I did the same, and was on the stair at his heels before I realized what an extraordinary way this was of approaching a stranger for money in the dead of night. But obviously Raffles and he were on exceptional terms of intimacy, and I could not but infer that they were in the habit of playing practical jokes upon each other. We groped our way so slowly upstairs that I had time to make more than one note before we reached the top. The stair was uncarpeted. The spread fingers of my right hand encountered nothing on the damp wall. Those of my left trailed through a dust that could be felt on the banisters. An eerie sensation had been upon me since we entered the house. It increased with every step we climbed. What hermit were we going to startle in his cell? We came to a landing. The banister led us to the left, and to the left again. Four steps more, and we were on another and a longer landing, and suddenly a match blazed from the black. I never heard it struck. Its flash was blinding.
When my eyes became accustomed to the light, there was Raffles holding up the match with one hand and shading it with the other, between bare boards, stripped walls, and the open doors of empty rooms. "Where have you brought me?" I cried. "The house is unoccupied!"
"Hush! Wait!"
he whispered, and he led the way into one of the empty rooms. His match went out as we crossed the threshold, and he struck another without the slightest noise. Then he stood with his back to me, fumbling with something that I could not see. But when he threw the second match away, there was some other light in its stead, and a slight smell of oil. I stepped forward to look over his shoulder, but before I could do so he had turned and flashed a tiny lantern in my face. "What's this?" I gasped. "What rotten trick are you going to play?"
"It's played,"
he answered, with his quiet laugh.
"On me?"
"I'm afraid so, Bunny."
"Is there no one in the house, then?"
"No one but ourselves."
"So it was mere chaff about your friend in Bond Street who could let us have that money?"
"Not altogether. It's quite true that Danby is a friend of mine."
"Danby?"
"The jeweller underneath."
"What do you mean?" I whispered, trembling like a leaf as his meaning dawned upon me. "Are we to get money from the jeweller?"
"Well, not exactly."
"What then?"
"The equivalent. From his shop."
There was no need for another question. I understood everything but my own density. He had given me a dozen hints, and I had taken none. And there I stood, staring at him in that empty room, and there he stood, with his dark lantern, laughing at me. "A burglar?" I gasped. You?
"I told you I lived by my wits."
"Why couldn't you tell me what you were going to do? Why couldn't you trust me? Why must you lie?" I demanded, piqued to the quick for all my horror.
"I wanted to tell you," said he. "I was on the point of telling you more than once. You may remember how I sounded you out about crime, though you have probably forgotten what you said yourself. I didn't think you meant it at the time, but I thought I'd put you to the test. Now I see you didn't. And I don't blame you. I only am to blame. Get out of it, my dear boy, as quick as you can. Leave it to me. You won't give me away, whatever else you do."
Oh, his cleverness! His fiendish cleverness! Had he fallen back on threats, coercion, sneers, all might have been different even yet. But he set me free to leave him in the lurch. He would not blame me. He did not even bind me to secrecy. He trusted me. He knew my weakness and my strength, and was playing on both with his master's touch. "Not so fast," said I. "Did I put this into your head, or were you going to do it in any case?"
"Not in any case," said Raffles. "It's true, I've had the key for days, but when I won tonight I thought of chucking it, for as a matter of fact it's not a one-man job."
"That settles it. I'm your man."
"You mean it?"
"Yes, for tonight."
"Good old Bunny,"
he murmured, holding the lantern for one moment to my face. The next he was explaining his plans, and I was nodding, as though we had been fellow cracksmen all our days.
"I know the shop," he whispered, "because I've got a few things there. I know this upper part, too. It's been to let for a month, and I got an order to view, and took a cast of the key before using it. The one thing I don't know is how to make a connection between the two. At present there's none. We may make it up here, though I rather fancy the basement myself. If you wait a minute I'll tell you."
He set his lantern on the floor, crept to a back window, and opened it with scarcely a sound, only to return shaking his head, after shutting the window with the same care.
"That was our one chance," said he. "A back window above a back window, but it's too dark to see anything, and we daren't show an outside light. Come down after me to the basement, and remember, though there's not a soul on the premises, you can't make too little noise. There, there, listen to that."
It was the measured tread that we had heard before on the flagstone outside. Raffles darkened his lantern, and again we stood motionless till it had passed.
"Either a policeman," he muttered, "or a watchman that all of these jewelers run between them. The watchman's the man for us to watch. He's simply paid to spot this kind of thing."
We crept very gingerly down the stairs, which creaked a bit in spite of us, and we picked up our shoes in the passage, then down some narrow stone steps, at the foot of which Raffles showed his light, and put on his shoes once more, bidding me do the same in a rather louder tone than he had permitted himself to employ overhead. We were now considerably below the level of the street, in a small space with as many doors as it had sides. Three were ajar, and we saw through them into empty cellars, but in the fourth a key was turned and a bolt drawn. And this one presently led us out into the bottom of a deep, square well of fog. A similar door faced it across this area, and Raffles had the lantern close against it and was hiding the light with his body, when a short and sudden crash made my heart stand still. Next moment I saw the door wide open, and Raffles standing within beckoning me with a jimmy.
"Door number one," he whispered. "Deuce knows how many more there'll be, but I know of two at least. We won't have to make much noise over them either. Down here there's less risk."
We were now at the bottom of the exact fellow to the narrow stone stair on which we had just descended, the yard, or well, being the one part common to both the private and the business premises. But this flight led to no open passage. Instead, a singularly solid mahogany door confronted us at the top.
"I thought so," muttered Raffles, handing me the lantern, and pocketing a bunch of skeleton keys after tampering for a few minutes with the lock. "It'll be an hour's work to get through that."
"Can't you pick it?"
"No, I know these locks. It's no use trying. We must cut it out. And it'll take us an hour."
It took us 47 minutes by my watch, or rather, it took Raffles, and never in my life have I seen anything more deliberately done. My part was simply to stand by with the dark lantern in one hand and a small bottle of rock oil in the other. Raffles had produced a pretty embroidered case, intended obviously for his razors, but filled instead with the tools of his secret trade, including the rock oil. From this case he selected a bit, capable of drilling a hole an inch in diameter, and fitted it to a small but very strong steel brace. Then he took off his covert coat and his blazer, spread them neatly on the top step, knelt on them, turned up his shirt cuffs, and went to work with brace and bit near the keyhole. But first he oiled the bit to minimize the noise, and this he did invariably before beginning a fresh hole, and often in the middle of one. It took 32 separate borings to cut around that lock. I noticed that through the first circular orifice Raffles thrust a forefinger. Then, as the circle became an ever-lengthening oval, he got his hand through up to the thumb, and I heard him swear softly to himself.
"I was afraid so."
"What is it?"
"An iron gate on the other side."
"How on earth are we to get through that?" I asked in dismay.
"Pick the lock, but there may be two. In that case they'll be top and bottom, and we shall have two fresh holes to make, as the door opens inwards. It won't open 2 inches as it is."
I confess I did not feel sanguine about the lock-picking, seeing that one lock had baffled us already, and my disappointment and impatience must have been a revelation to me had I stopped to think. The truth is that I was entering into our nefarious undertakings with an involuntary zeal of which I was myself quite unconscious at the time. The romance and peril of the whole proceeding held me spellbound and entranced. My moral sense and my sense of fear were stricken by a common paralysis, and there I stood, shining my light and holding my file with a keener interest than I had ever brought to any honest avocation. And there knelt A.J. Raffles, with his black hair tumbled, and the same watchful, quiet, determined half-smile with which I have seen him send down over after over in a county match. At last the chain of holes was complete, the lock wrenched out bodily, and a splendid bare arm plunged up to the shoulder through the aperture and through the bars of the iron gate beyond.
"Now," whispered Raffles, "if there's only one lock, it'll be in the middle." "Joy, here it is! Only let me pick it, and we're through at last."
He withdrew his arm. A skeleton key was selected from a bunch, and then back went his arm to the shoulder. It was a breathless moment. I heard the heart throbbing in my body, the very watch ticking in my pocket, and ever and anon the tinkle-tinkle of the skeleton key. Then, at last, there came a single unmistakable click. In another minute the mahogany door and the iron gate yawned behind us, and Raffles was sitting on an office table, wiping his face, with the lantern throwing a steady beam by his side. We were now in a bare and roomy lobby behind the shop, but separated therefrom by an iron curtain, the very sight of which filled me with despair. Raffles, however, did not appear in the least depressed, but hung up his coat and hat on some pegs in the lobby before examining this curtain with his lantern.
"That's nothing," said he after a minute's inspection. "We'll be through that in no time, but there's a door on the other side which may give us trouble."
"Another door?" I groaned. "And how do you mean to tackle this thing?"
"Prise it up with the jointed jimmy. The weak point of these iron curtains is the leverage you can get from below. But it makes a noise. And this is where you're coming in, Bunny. This is where I couldn't do without you. I must have you overhead to knock through when the street is clear. I'll come with you and show a light."
Well, you may imagine how little I liked the prospect of this lonely vigil. And yet, there was something very stimulating in the vital responsibility which it involved. Hitherto I had been a mere spectator. Now I was to take part in the game, and the fresh excitement made me more than ever insensible to those considerations of conscience and of safety which were already as dead nerves in my breast. So I took my post without a murmur in the front room above the shop. The fixtures had been left for the refusal of the incoming tenant, and fortunately for us they included Venetian blinds which were already down. It was the simplest matter in the world to stand peeping through the lathes into the street, to beat twice with my foot when anybody was approaching, and once when all was clear again. The noises that even I could hear below, with the exception of one metallic crash at the beginning, were indeed incredibly slight, but they ceased altogether at each double rap from my toe, and a policeman passed quite half a dozen times beneath my eyes, and the man whom I took to be the jeweler's watchman oftener still, during the better part of an hour that I spent at the window. Once, indeed, my heart was in my mouth, but only once. It was when the watchman stopped and peered through the peephole into the lighted shop. I waited for his whistle. I waited for the gallows or the jail. But my signal had been studiously obeyed, and the man passed on in undisturbed serenity. In the end, I had a signal in my turn, and retraced my steps with lighted matches down the broad stairs, down the narrow ones, across the area, and up into the lobby where Raffles awaited me with an outstretched hand.
"Well done, my boy," said he. "You're the same good man in a pinch, and you shall have your reward. I've got £1,000 worth if I've got a penneth. It's all in my pockets. And here's something else I found in this locker. Very decent port and some cigars. Meant for poor dear Danby's business friends. Take a pull and you shall light up presently. I've found a lavatory, too, and we must have a wash and brush up before we go, for I'm as black as your boot."
The iron curtain was down, but he insisted on raising it until I could peep through the glass door on the other side and see his handiwork in the shop beyond. Here two electric lights were left burning all night, and in their cold white rays I could at first see nothing amiss. I looked along an orderly lane, an empty glass counter on my left, glass cupboards of untouched silver on my right, and facing me the filmy black eye of the peephole that shone like a stage moon on the street. The counter had not been emptied by Raffles. Its contents were in the Chubb safe, which he had given up at a glance. Nor had he looked at the silver, except to choose a cigarette case for me. He had confined himself entirely to the shop window. This was in three compartments, each secured for the night by removable panels with separate locks. Raffles had removed them a few hours before their time, and the electric light shone on a corrugated shutter bare as the ribs of an empty carcass. Every article of value was gone from the one place which was invisible from the little window in the door. Elsewhere, all was as it had been left overnight. And but for a train of mangled doors behind the iron curtain, a bottle of wine and a cigar-box, with which liberties had been taken, a rather black towel in the lavatory, a burnt match here and there, and our finger-marks on the dusty banisters, not a trace of our visit did we leave.
"Had it in my head for long?"
said Raffles as we strolled through the streets towards dawn, for all the world as though we were returning from a dance.
"No, Bunny, I never thought of it till I saw that upper part empty about a month ago, and bought a few things in the shop to get the lie of the land. That reminds me that I never paid for them, but by Jove I will to-morrow, and if that isn't poetic justice, what is? One visit showed me the possibilities of the place, but a second convinced me of its impossibilities without a pal. So I had practically given up the idea when you came along on the very night and in the very plight for it. But here we are at the Albany, and I hope there's some fire left. For I don't know how you feel, Bunny, but for my part I'm as cold as Keats's owl."
He could think of Keats on his way from a felony. He could hanker for his fireside like another. Floodgates were loosed within me, and the plain English of our adventure rushed over me as cold as ice. Raffles was a burglar. I had helped him to commit one burglary. Therefore I was a burglar too. Yet I could stand and warm myself by his fire, and watch him empty his pockets, as though we had done nothing wonderful or wicked. My blood froze, my heart sickened, my brain whirled. How I had liked this villain! How I had admired him! Now my liking and admiration must turn to loathing and disgust. I waited for the change. I longed to feel it in my heart, but I longed and I waited in vain. I saw that he was emptying his pockets. The table sparkled with their hoard. Rings by the dozen, diamonds by the score, bracelets, pendants, aigrettes, necklaces, pearls, rubies, amethysts, sapphires, and diamonds always, diamonds in everything, flashing bayonets of light, dazzling me, blinding me, making me disbelieve because I could no longer forget. Last of all came no gem indeed, but my own revolver from an inner pocket, and that struck a chord. I suppose I said something. My hand flew out. I can see Raffles now, as he looked at me once more with a high arch over each clear eye. I can see him pick out the cartridges with his quiet, cynical smile before he would give me my pistol back again.
"You mayn't believe it, Bunny," said he, "but I never carried a loaded one before. On the whole, I think it gives one confidence. Yet it would be very awkward if anything went wrong. One might use it, and that's not the game at all. Though I have often thought that the murderer who has just done the trick must have great sensations before things get too hot for him. Don't look so distressed, my dear chap. I've never had those sensations, and I don't suppose I ever shall."
"But this much you have done before?" said I hoarsely.
"Before? My dear Bunny, you offend me. Did it look like a first attempt? Of course I have done it before."
"Often?"
"Well, no. Not often enough to destroy the charm, at all events. Never, as a matter of fact, unless I'm cursedly hard up. Did you hear about the Thimbley diamonds? Well, that was the last time, and a poor lot of paste they were. Then there was a little business of the Dormer House boat at Henley last year. That was mine also, such as it was. I never brought off a really big coup yet. When I do, I shall chuck it up."
Yes, I remembered both cases very well. To think that he was their author! It was incredible, outrageous, inconceivable! Then my eyes would fall upon the table, twinkling and glittering in a hundred places, and incredulity was at an end. "How came you to begin?" I asked, as curiosity overcame mere wonder, and a fascination for his career gradually wove itself into my fascination for the man.
"Ah, that's a long story," said Raffles. "It was in the colonies when I was out there playing cricket. It's too long a story to tell you now, but I was in much the same fix that you were in to-night, and it was my only way out. I never meant it for anything more, but I'd tasted blood, and it was all over with me. Why should I work when I could steal? Why settle down to some humdrum, uncongenial billet when excitement, romance, danger, and a decent living were all going begging together? Of course, it's very wrong, but we can't all be moralists, and the distribution of wealth is very wrong to begin with. Besides, you're not at it all the time. I'm sick of quoting Gilbert's lines to myself, but they're profoundly true. I only wonder if you'll like the life as much as I do."
"Like it!" I cried out. "Not I! It's no life for me. Once is enough."
"You wouldn't give me a hand another time?"
"Don't ask me, Raffles. Don't ask me, for God's sake!"
"Yet you said you would do anything for me. You asked me to name my crime. But I knew at the time you didn't mean it. You didn't go back on me to-night, and that ought to satisfy me, goodness knows. I suppose I'm ungrateful and unreasonable and all that. I ought to let it end at this. But you're the very man for me, Bunny, the very man. Just think how we got through to-night. Not a scratch, not a hitch. There's nothing very terrible in it, you see. There never would be, while we worked together."
He was standing in front of me with a hand on either shoulder. He was smiling as he knew so well how to smile. I turned on my heel, planted my elbows on the chimney-piece and my burning head between my hands. Next instant, a still heartier hand fell on my back.
"All right, my boy. You are quite right, and I'm worse than wrong. I'll never ask it again. Go if you want to, and come again about midday for the cash. There was no bargain, but of course I'll get you out of your scrape, especially after the way you've stood by me to-night."
I was round again with my blood on fire. "I'll do it again," I said through my teeth. He shook his head.
"Not you,"
he said, smiling quite good-humouredly on my insane enthusiasm. "I will," I cried with an oath. "I'll lend you a hand as often as you like. What does it matter now? I've been in it once. I'll be in it again. I've gone to the devil anyhow. I can't go back, and wouldn't if I could. Nothing matters another rap. When you want me, I'm your man." And that is how Raffles and I joined felonious forces on the Ides of March. End of The Ides of March. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Kristen Hughes. The Amateur Cracksman by E. W. Horning. A Costume Piece. London was just then talking of one whose name is already a name and nothing more. Reuben Rosenthal had made his millions on the diamond fields of South Africa, and had come home to enjoy them according to his lights. How he went to work will scarcely be forgotten by any reader of the halfpenny evening papers, which revelled in endless anecdotes of his original indigence and present prodigality, varied with interesting particulars of the extraordinary establishment which the millionaire set up in St. John's Wood. Here he kept a retinue of Kaffirs, who were literally his slaves, and hence he would sally, with enormous diamonds in his shirt and on his finger, in the convoy of a prize-fighter of heinous repute, who was not, however, by any means the worst element in the Rosenthal melange. So said common gossip, but the fact was sufficiently established by the interference of the police on at least one occasion, followed by certain magisterial proceedings which were reported with justifiable gusto and huge headlines in the newspapers aforesaid. And this was all one knew of Reuben Rosenthal up to the time when the old Bohemian Club, having fallen on evil days, found it worth its while to organize a great dinner in honor of so wealthy an exponent of the club's principles. I was not at the banquet myself, but a member took Raffles, who told me all about it that very night.
"The most extraordinary show I ever went to in my life," said he. "As for the man himself, well, I was prepared for something grotesque, but the fellow fairly took my breath away. To begin with, he's the most astounding brute to look at, well over 6 feet, with a chest like a barrel and a great hook nose, and the reddest hair and whiskers you ever saw. Drank like a fire engine, but only got drunk enough to make us a speech that I wouldn't have missed for 10 pounds. I'm only sorry you weren't there too, Bunny, old chap."
I began to be sorry myself, for Raffles was anything but an excitable person, and never had I seen him so excited before. Had he been following Rosenthal's example? His coming to my rooms at midnight, merely to tell me about his dinner, was in itself enough to excuse a suspicion which was certainly at variance with my knowledge of A.J. Raffles. "What did he say?" I inquired mechanically, divining some subtler explanation of this visit, and wondering what on earth it could be.
"Say!" cried Raffles. "What did he not say? He boasted of his rise, he bragged of his riches, and he blackguarded society for taking him up for his money and dropping him out of sheer pique and jealousy because he had so much. He mentioned names, too, with the most charming freedom, and swore he was as good a man as the old country had to show, pace the old Bohemians. To prove it, he pointed to a great diamond in the middle of his shirt front, with a little finger loaded with another just like it. Which of our bloated princes could show a pair like that? As a matter of fact, they seemed quite wonderful stones, with a curious purple gleam to them that must mean a pot of money. But old Rosenthal swore he wouldn't take 50,000 pounds for the two, and wanted to know where the other man was who went about with 25,000 in his shirt front, and another 25 on his little finger. He didn't exist. If he did, he wouldn't have the pluck to wear them. But he had. He'd tell us why. And before you could say Jack Robinson, he had whipped out a whacking great revolver."
"Not at the table?"
"At the table, in the middle of his speech. But it was nothing to what he wanted to do. He actually wanted us to let him write his name in bullets on the opposite wall, to show us why he wasn't afraid to go about in all his diamonds. That brute Purvis, the prize-fighter, who is his paid bully, had to bully his master before he could be persuaded out of it. There was quite a panic for the moment. One fellow was saying his prayers under the table, and the waiters bolted to a man."
"What a grotesque scene!"
"Grotesque enough. But I rather wish they had let him go the whole hog and blaze away. He was as keen as knives to show us how he could take care of his purple diamonds. And do you know, Bunny, I was as keen as knives to see."
And Raffles leaned towards me with a sly, slow smile that made the hidden meaning of his visit only too plain to me at last. "So you think of having a try for his diamonds yourself?" He shrugged his shoulders.
"It's horribly obvious, I admit. But, yes, I have my heart set upon them. To be quite frank, I have had them on my conscience for some time. One couldn't hear so much of the man and his prize-fighter and his diamonds without feeling it a kind of duty to have a go for them. But when it comes to brandishing a revolver and practically challenging the world, that thing becomes inevitable. It is simply thrust upon one. I was fated to hear that challenge, Bunny, and I, for one, must take it up. I was only sorry I couldn't get on my hind legs and say so then and there."
"Well," I said, "I don't see the necessity as things are with us, but of course I'm your man." My tone may have been half-hearted. I did my best to make it otherwise, but it was barely a month since our Bond Street exploit, and we certainly could have afforded to behave ourselves for some time to come. We had been getting along so nicely. By his advice I had scribbled a thing or two, inspired by Raffles. I had even done an article on our own jewel robbery. and for the moment I was quite satisfied with this sort of adventure. I thought we ought to know when we were well off, and could see no point in our running fresh risks before we were obliged. On the other hand, I was anxious not to show the least disposition to break the pledge that I had given a month ago. But it was not on my manifest disinclination that Raffles fastened.
"Necessity, my dear Bunny! Does the writer only write when the wolf is at the door? Does the painter paint for bread alone? Must you and I be driven to crime like Tom of Bow and Dick of Whitechapel? You pain me, my dear chap. You needn't laugh, because you do. Art, for art's sake, is a vile catchword, but I confess it appeals to me. In this case, my motives are absolutely pure, for I doubt if we shall ever be able to dispose of such peculiar stones. But if I don't have a try for them, after to-night, I shall never be able to hold up my head again."
His eye twinkled, but it glittered too. "We shall have our work cut out," was all I said.
"And do you suppose I should be keen on it if we hadn't?" cried Raffles. "My dear fellow, I would rob St. Paul's Cathedral if I could. But I could no more scoop a till when the shopwalker wasn't looking than I could bag the apples out of an old woman's basket. Even that little business last month was a sordid affair, but it was necessary, and I think its strategy redeemed it to some extent. Now there's some credit and more sport in going where they boast they're on their guard against you. The Bank of England, for example, is the ideal crib, but that would need half a dozen of us with years to give to the job. And meanwhile, Reuben Rosenthal is high enough game for you and me. We know he's armed. We know how Billy Purvis can fight. It'll be no soft thing, I grant you. But what of that, my good Bunny, what of that? A man's reach must extend his grasp, dear boy, or what the dickens is a heaven for?"
"I would rather we didn't exceed ours just yet," I answered, laughing, for his spirit was irresistible, and the plan was growing upon me, despite my qualms.
"Trust me for that," was his reply. "I'll see you through. After all, I expect to find that the difficulties are nearly all on the surface. These fellows both drink like the devil, and that should simplify matters considerably. But we shall see, and we must take our time. There will probably turn out to be a dozen different ways in which the thing might be done, and we shall have to choose between them. It will mean watching the house for at least a week in any case. It may mean lots of other things that will take much longer. But give me a week, and I will tell you more. That's to say, if you're really on."
"Of course I am," I replied indignantly. "But why should I give you a week? Why shouldn't we watch the house together?"
"Because two eyes are as good as four and take up less room. Never hunt in couples unless you're obliged. But don't you look offended, Bunny. There'll be plenty for you to do when the time comes. That I promise you. You shall have your share of the fun, never fear, and a purple diamond all to yourself if we're lucky."
On the whole, however, this conversation left me less than lukewarm, and I still remember the depression which came upon me when Raffles was gone. I saw the folly of the enterprise to which I had committed myself, the sheer, gratuitous, unnecessary folly of it, and the paradoxes in which Raffles revelled, and the frivolous casuistry which was nevertheless half-sincere, and which his mere personality rendered wholly plausible at the moment of utterance, appealed very little to me when recalled in cold blood. I admired the spirit of pure mischief in which he seemed prepared to risk his liberty and his life, but I did not find it an infectious spirit on calm reflection. Yet the thought of withdrawal was not to be entertained for a moment. On the contrary, I was impatient of the delay ordained by Raffles, and perhaps no small part of my secret disaffection came from his galling determination to do without me until the last moment. It made it no better that this was characteristic of the man and of his attitude toward me. For a month we had been, I suppose, the thickest thieves in all London. And yet our intimacy was curiously incomplete. With all his charming frankness, there was in Raffles a vein of capricious reserve, which was perceptible enough to be very irritating. He had the instinctive secretiveness of the inveterate criminal. He would make mysteries of matters of common concern. For example, I never knew how or where he disposed of the Bond Street jewels. on the proceeds of which we were both still leading the outward lives of hundreds of other young fellows about town. He was consistently mysterious about that and other details, of which it seemed to me that I had already earned the right to know everything. I could not but remember how he had led me into my first felony, by means of a trick, while yet uncertain whether he could trust me or not. That I could no longer afford to resent, but I did resent his want of confidence in me now. I said nothing about it, but it rankled every day, and never more than in the week that succeeded the Rosenthal dinner. When I met Raffles at the club, he would tell me nothing. When I went to his rooms, he was out, or pretended to be. One day he told me he was getting on well, but slowly. It was a more ticklish game than he had thought. But when I began to ask questions, he would say no more. Then and there, in my annoyance, I took my own decision. Since he would tell me nothing of the result of his vigils, I determined to keep one on my own account, and that very evening found my way to the millionaire's front gates. The house he was occupying is, I believe, quite the largest in the St. John's Wood district. It stands in the angle formed by two broad thoroughfares, neither of which, as it happens, is a bus route, and I doubt if many quieter spots exist within the 4-mile radius. Quiet also was the great square house in its garden of grass plots and shrubs. The lights were low, the millionaire and his friends obviously spending their evening elsewhere. The garden walls were only a few feet high. In one there was a side door opening into a glass passage, in the other two 5-barred, grained and varnished gates, one at either end of the little semicircular drive, and both wide open. So still was the place that I had a great mind to walk boldly in and learn something of the premises. In fact, I was on the point of doing so when I heard a quick shuffling step on the pavement behind me. I turned round and faced the dark scowl and the dirty clenched fists of a dilapidated tramp.
"You fool!" said he. "You utter idiot!"
"Raffles?"
"That's it," he whispered savagely. "Tell all the neighborhood. Give me away at the top of your voice."
With that, he turned his back upon me and shambled down the road, shrugging his shoulders and muttering to himself as though I had refused him alms. A few moments I stood astounded, indignant, at a loss. Then I followed him. His feet trailed, his knees gave, his back was bowed, his head kept nodding. It was the gait of a man 80 years of age. Presently, he waited for me midway between two lamp-posts. As I came up, he was lighting rank tobacco in a cuddy pipe, with an evil-smelling match, and the flame showed me the suspicion of a smile.
"You must forgive my heat, Bunny, but it really was very foolish of you. Here I am trying every dodge, begging at the door one night, hiding in the shrubs the next, doing every mortal thing but stand and stare at the house as you went and did. It's a costume piece, and in you rush in your ordinary clothes. I tell you, they're on the lookout for us night and day. It's the toughest nut I ever tackled."
"Well," said I, "if you had told me so before, I shouldn't have come. You told me nothing." He looked hard at me from under the broken brim of a battered billycock.
"You're right," he said at length. "I've been too close. It's become second nature with me when I've anything on. But here's an end of it, Bunny, so far as you're concerned. I'm going home now, and I want you to follow me. But for heaven's sake keep your distance, and don't speak to me again till I speak to you. There, give me a start."
And he was off again, a decrepit vagabond with his hands in his pockets, his elbows squared, and frayed coat-tails swinging raggedly from side to side. I followed him to the Finchley Road. There he took an Atlas omnibus, and I sat some rows behind him on the top, but not far enough to escape the pest of his vile tobacco. That he could carry his character sketch to such a pitch, he who would only smoke one brand of cigarette! It was the last, least touch of the insatiable artist, and it charmed away what mortification there still remained in me. Once more I felt the fascination of a comrade who was forever dazzling one with a fresh and unsuspected facet of his character. As we neared Piccadilly, I wondered what he would do. Surely he was not going into the Albany like that. No. He took another omnibus to Sloane Street, I sitting behind him as before. At Sloane Street we changed again, and were presently in the long lean artery of the King's Road. I was now all agog to know our destination. Nor was I kept many more minutes in doubt. Raffles got down. I followed. He crossed the road and disappeared up a dark turning. I pressed after him, and was in time to see his coat-tails as he plunged into a still darker flagged alley to the right. He was holding himself up and stepping out like a young man once more. Also, in some subtle way, he already looked less disreputable. But I alone was there to see him. The alley was absolutely deserted and desperately dark. At the further end he opened a door with a latch-key, and it was darker yet within. Instinctively I drew back, and heard him chuckle. We could no longer see each other.
"All right, Bunny. There's no hanky-panky this time. These are studios, my friend, and I'm one of the lawful tenants."
Indeed, in another minute we were in a lofty room with skylight, easels, dressing-cupboard, platform, and every other adjunct save the signs of actual labor. The first thing I saw, as Raffles lit the gas, was its reflection in his silk hat on the pegs beside the rest of his normal garments.
"Looking for the works of art?"
continued Raffles, lighting a cigarette and beginning to divest himself of his rags.
"I'm afraid you won't find any. But there's the canvas I'm always going to make a start upon. I tell them I'm looking high and low for my ideal model. I have the stove lit on principle twice a week, and I look in and leave a newspaper and a smell of Sullivan's. How good they are after shag! Meanwhile I pay my rent, and am a good tenant in every way, and it's a very useful little pied-à-terre. There's no saying how useful it might be at a pinch. As it is, the billycock comes in and the topper goes out, and nobody takes the slightest notice of either. At this time of night, the chances are that there's not a soul in the building except ourselves."
"You never told me you went in for disguises," said I, watching him as he cleansed the grime from his face and hands.
"No, Bunny. I've treated you very shabbily all round. There was really no reason why I shouldn't have shown you this place a month ago, and yet there was no point in my doing so. And circumstances are just conceivable in which it would have suited us both for you to be in genuine ignorance of my whereabouts. I have something to sleep on, as you perceive, in case of need, and, of course, my name is not Raffles in the King's Road. So you will see that one might bolt further and fare worse."
"Meanwhile, you use the place as a dressing-room?"
"It is my private pavilion," said Raffles. "Disguises? In some cases they're half the battle, and it's always pleasant to feel that if the worst comes to the worst, you needn't necessarily be convicted under your own name. Then they're indispensable in dealing with the fences. I drive all my bargains in the tongue and raiment of Shoreditch. If I didn't, there'd be the very devil to pay in blackmail. Now, this cupboard's full of all sorts of toggery. I tell the woman who cleans the room that it's for my models when I find 'em. By the way, I only hope I've got something that'll fit you, for you'll want a rig for tomorrow night."
"Tomorrow night?" I exclaimed. "Why, what do you mean to do?"
"The trick," said Raffles. "I intended writing to you as soon as I got back to my rooms, to ask you to look me up tomorrow afternoon. Then I was going to unfold my plan of campaign, and take you straight into action then and there. There's nothing like putting the nervous players in first. It's the sitting with their pads on that upsets their apple-cart. That was another of my reasons for being so confoundedly close. You must try to forgive me. I couldn't help remembering how well you played up last trip, without any time to weaken on it beforehand. All I want is for you to be as cool and smart tomorrow night as you were then. Though, by Jove, there's no comparison between the two cases."
"I thought you would find it so."
"You are right, I have. Mind you, I don't say this will be the tougher job all round. We shall probably get in without any difficulty at all. It's the getting out again that may flummox us. That's the worst of an irregular household,"
cried Raffles, with quite a burst of virtuous indignation.
"I assure you, Bunny, I spent the whole of Monday night in the shrubbery of the garden next door, looking over the wall, and if you'll believe me, somebody was about all night long. I don't mean the Kaffirs. I don't believe they ever get to bed at all, poor devils. No, I mean Rosenthal himself, and that pasty-faced beast Purvis. They were up and drinking from midnight when they came in to broad daylight when I cleared out. Even then I left them sober enough to slang each other. By the way, they very nearly came to blows in the garden, within a few yards of me, and I heard something that might come in useful, and make Rosenthal shoot crooked at a critical moment. You know what an IDB is?"
"Illicit diamond buyer?"
"Exactly. Well, it seems that Rosenthal was one. He must have let it out to Purvis in his cups. Anyhow, I heard Purvis taunting him with it, and threatening him with the breakwater at Cape Town, and I begin to think our friends are friend and foe. But about tomorrow night, there's nothing subtle in my plan. It's simply to get in while these fellows are out on the loose, and to lie low till they come back, and longer. If possible, we must doctor the whiskey. That would simplify the whole thing. Though it's not a very sporting game to play, still, we must remember Rosenthal's revolver. We don't want him to sign his name on us. With all those Kaffirs about, however, it's 10 to 1 on the whiskey, and 100 to 1 against us if we go looking for it. A brush with the heathen would spoil everything if it did no more. Besides, there are the ladies."
"The deuce there are!"
"Ladies with an eye. The very voices for raising Cain. I fear the clamour. It would be fatal to us. Au contraire, if we can manage to stow ourselves away unbeknownst, half the battle will be won. If Rosenthal turns in drunk, it's a purple diamond apiece. If he sits up sober, it may be a bullet instead. We will hope not, Bunny. And all the firing wouldn't be on one side. But it's on the knees of the gods."
And so we left it when we shook hands in Piccadilly, not by any means as much later as I could have wished. Raffles would not ask me to his rooms that night. He said he made it a rule to have a long night before playing cricket and other games. His final word to me was framed on the same principle.
"Mind, only one drink tonight, Bunny. 2 at the outside, as you value your life and mine."
I remember my abject obedience, and the endless sleepless night it gave me, and the roofs of the houses opposite standing out at last against the blue-gray London dawn. I wondered whether I should ever see another, and was very hard on myself for that little expedition which I had made on my own willful account. It was between 8 and 9 o'clock in the evening when we took up our position in the garden adjoining that of Reuben Rosenthal. The house itself was shut up, thanks to the outrageous libertine next door, who, by driving away the neighbors, had gone far towards delivering himself into our hands. Practically secure from surprise on that side, we could watch our house under cover of a wall just high enough to see over, while a fair margin of shrubs in either garden afforded us additional protection. Thus entrenched, we had stood an hour, watching a pair of lighted bow windows with vague shadows flitting continually across the blinds, and listening to the drawing of corks, the clink of glasses, and a gradual crescendo of coarse voices within. Our luck seemed to have deserted us. The owner of the purple diamonds was dining at home, and dining at undue length. I thought it was a dinner party. Raffles differed. In the end, he proved right. Wheels grated in the drive. A carriage and pair stood at the steps. There was a stampede from the dining-room, and the loud voices died away, to burst forth presently from the porch. Let me make our position perfectly clear. We were over the wall at the side of the house, but a few feet from the dining-room windows. On our right, one angle of the building cut the back lawn in 2 diagonally. On our left, another angle just permitted us to see the jutting steps and the waiting carriage. We saw Rosenthal come out, saw the glimmer of his diamonds before anything. Then came the pugilist, then a lady with a head of hair like a bath-sponge, then another, and the party was complete. Raffles ducked and pulled me down in great excitement.
"The ladies are going with them," he whispered. "This is great."
"That's better still."
"The gardenia!"
the millionaire had bawled.
"And that's the best of all," said Raffles, standing upright as hoofs and wheels crunched through the gates and rattled off at a fine speed.
"Now what?" I whispered, trembling with excitement.
"They'll be clearing away. Yes, here comes their shadows. The drawing-room windows open on the lawn. Bunny, it's the psychological moment. Where's that mask?"
I produced it with a hand whose trembling I tried in vain to still, and could have died for Raffles when he made no comment on what he could not fail to notice. His own hands were firm and cool as he adjusted my mask for me, and then his own.
"By Jove, old boy," he whispered cheerily, "you look about the greatest ruffian I ever saw. These masks alone will down a nigger if we meet one. But I'm glad I remembered to tell you not to shave. You'll pass for Whitechapel if the worst comes to the worst, and you don't forget to talk the lingo. Better sulk like a mule if you're not sure of it, and leave the dialogue to me. But, please our stars, there will be no need. Now, are you ready?
Quite.
Got your gag?
Yes.
Shooter?
Yes.
Then follow me.
In an instant we were over the wall, in another on the lawn behind the house. There was no moon. The very stars in their courses had veiled themselves for our benefit. I crept at my leader's heels to some French windows opening upon a shallow veranda. He pushed. They yielded.
"Luck again," he whispered. "Nothing but luck. Now for a light."
And the light came. A good score of electric burners glowed red for the fraction of a second, then rained merciless white beams into our blinded eyes. When we found our sight, four revolvers covered us, and between two of them the colossal frame of Reuben Rosenthal shook with a wheezy laughter from head to foot.
"Good evening, boys," he hiccuped. "Glad to see you at last. Shift foot or finger, you on the left, though, and you're a dead boy. I mean you, you greaser," he roared out at Raffles. "I know you. I've been waiting for you. I've been watching you all this week. Plucky smart you thought yourself, didn't you? One day beggin', next time shammin' tight, and next one of them old pals from Kimberley that never come when I'm in. But you left the same tracks every day, you buggins, and the same tracks every night, all around the blessed premises." "All right, guv'nor," drawled Raffles. "Don't excite. It's a fair cop. We don't sweat to know how you brung it orf. Only don't you go for a shoot, 'cause we ain't armed, so help me God." "Ah, you're a knowin' one," said Rosenthal, fingering his triggers. "But you've struck a knowiner." "Oh, yes, we know all about that. Set a thief to catch a thief, oh, yes."
My eyes had torn themselves from the brown-black muzzles, from the accursed diamonds that had been our snare. The pasty pig-face of the overfed pugilist, and the flaming cheeks and hook-nose of Rosenthal himself. I was looking beyond them at the doorway filled with quivering silk and plush, black faces, white eyeballs, woolly pates. But a sudden silence recalled my attention to the millionaire, and only his nose retained its color.
"What do you mean?" he whispered with a hoarse oath. "Spit it out, or by Christmas I'll drill you!"
"What price that breakwater?" drawled Raffles coolly.
"Eh?"
Rosenthal's revolvers were describing widening orbits.
"What price that breakwater, old IDB?" "Where in hell did you get hold of that?"
asked Rosenthal, with a rattle in his thick neck meant for mirth.
"You may well arst," says Raffles. "It's all over the place where I come from. Who can have spread such rot?"
"I dunno," says Raffles. "Arst the gentleman on your left, p'raps. He knows."
The gentleman on his left had turned livid with emotion. Guilty conscience never declared itself in plainer terms. For a moment his small eyes bulged like currants in the suet of his face. The next he had pocketed his pistols on a professional instinct, and was upon us with his fists.
"Out of the light! Out of the light!"
yelled Rosenthal in a frenzy. He was too late. No sooner had the burly pugilist obstructed his fire than Raffles was through the window at a bound, while I, for standing still and saying nothing, was scientifically felled to the floor. I cannot have been many moments without my senses. When I recovered them, there was a great to-do in the garden, but I had the drawing-room to myself. I sat up. Rosenthal and Purvis were rushing about outside, cursing the Kaffirs and nagging at each other.
"Over that wall, I tell yer! I tell you it was this one. Can't you whistle for the police?"
"Police be damned. I've had enough of the blessed police."
"Then we better get back and make sure of the other rotter."
"Oh, make sure of your skin. That's what you'd better do. Jala, you black hog, if I catch you skulkin'—"
I never heard the threat. I was creeping from the drawing-room on my hands and knees, my own revolver swinging by its steel ring from my teeth. For an instant I thought that the hall was also deserted. I was wrong, and I crept upon a Kaffir on all fours. Poor devil! I could not bring myself to deal him a base blow, but I threatened him most hideously with my revolver, and left the white teeth chattering in his black head as I took the stairs three at a time. Why I went upstairs in that decisive fashion, as though it were my only course, I cannot explain. but garden and ground floor seemed alive with men, and I might have done worse. I turned into the first room I came to. It was a bedroom, empty, though lit up. And never shall I forget how I started as I entered, on encountering the awful villain that was myself at full length in a pier-glass. Masked, armed, and ragged, I was indeed fit carrion for a bullet or the hangman. And to one or the other I made up my mind. Nevertheless, I hid myself in the wardrobe behind the mirror, and there I stood shivering and cursing my fate, my folly, and Raffles most of all. Raffles first and last, for I dare say half an hour. Then the wardrobe door was flung suddenly open. They had stolen into the room without a sound, and I was hauled downstairs, an ignominious captive. Gross scenes followed in the hall. The ladies were now upon the stage, and at sight of the desperate criminal they screamed with one accord. In truth, I must have given them fair cause, though my mask was now torn away and hid nothing but my left ear. Rosenthal answered their shrieks with a roar for silence. The woman with the bath-sponge hair swore at him shrilly in return. The place became a babble impossible to describe. I remember wondering how long it would be before the police appeared. Purvis and the ladies were for calling them in and giving me in charge without delay. Rosenthal would not hear of it. He swore that he would shoot man or woman who left his sight. He had had enough of the police. He was not going to have them coming there to spoil sport. He was going to deal with me in his own way. With that he dragged me from all other hands, flung me against a door, and sent a bullet crashing through the wood within an inch of my ear. "You drunken fool! It'll be murder!" shouted Purvis, getting in the way a second time.
"What do I care? He's armed, isn't he? I shot him in self-defense. It'll be a warning to others. Will you stand aside, or do you want it yourself?"
"You're drunk," said Purvis, still between us.
"I saw you take a neat tumblerful since you come in, and it's made you drunk as a fool. Pull yourself together, old man. You ain't a-goin' to do what you'll be sorry for." "Then I won't shoot him at all. I'll only shoot round and round the beggar. You're quite right, old feller. Wouldn't hurt him. Great mistake. Round and round, there, like that."
His freckled paw shot up over Purvis's shoulder. Mauve lightning came from his ring, a red flash from his revolver, and shrieks from the women as the reverberations died away. Some splinters lodged in my hair. Next instant the prize-fighter disarmed him, and I was safe from the devil, but finally doomed to the deep sea. A policeman was in our midst. He had entered through the drawing-room window. He was an officer of few words and credible promptitude. In a twinkling he had the handcuffs on my wrists while the pugilist explained the situation, and his patron reviled the force and its representative with impotent malignity. A fine watch they kept, a lot of good they did, coming in when it was all over and the whole household might have been murdered in their sleep. The officer only deigned to notice him as he marched me off.
"We know all about you, sir,"
he said contemptuously, and he refused the sovereign Purvis offered.
"You will be seeing me again, sir, at Marylebone."
"Shall I come now?"
"As you please, sir. I rather think the other gentleman requires you more, and I don't fancy this man means to give much trouble."
"Oh, I'm coming quietly," I said, and I went. In silence we traversed perhaps 100 yards. It must have been midnight. We did not meet a soul. At last I whispered, "How on earth did you manage it?"
"Purely by luck," said Raffles. "I had the luck to get clear away through knowing every brick of those back-garden walls, and the double luck to have these togs with the rest over at Chelsea. The helmet is one of a collection I made up at Oxford. Here it goes over this wall, and we'd better carry the coat and belt before we meet a real officer. I got them once for a fancy ball, ostensibly, and thereby hangs a yarn. I always thought they might come in useful a second time. My chief crux to-night was getting rid of the hansom that brought me back. I sent him off to Scotland Yard with 10 bob and a special message to good old Mackenzie. The whole detective department will be at Rosenthal's in about half an hour. Of course, I speculated on our gentleman's hatred of the police. Another huge slice of luck. If you'd got away, well and good. If not, I felt he was the man to play with his mouse as long as possible. Yes, Bunny, it's been more of a costume piece than I intended, and we've come out of it with a good deal less credit. But by Jove, we're jolly lucky to have come out of it at all."
End of A Costume Piece.